Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Tight Race by Elizabeth Sims, narrated by Dina Perlman.
1. Come here, you, said the woman in the black cocktail dress and cream-colored pearls. In the soft light of room 1952 in the Book Cadillac Hotel, she looked as gorgeous as I'd ever seen her, like a woman in a Sargent painting, half brooding, half inviting. A strand of dark hair falling over one eye, a hip cocked expectantly. In one graceful hand she held a brandy glass with a skosh of amber liquid in it. As I crossed the room, she took the last sip and set the glass down. Marie Chamberlain was her name, and this was the last time I'd see her alive. And had I known that, I'd have handled our final night together differently. I took her in my arms and kissed her. Her scent was intoxicating, the warm flesh of her neck mingling with her classic Chanel fragrance, her breath spicy from the brandy. The liquor was an extra fine something or other that cost $100 a glass from room service. Marie always chose the best, and she could pay for it. Which makes me laugh to think of her being attracted to me. "Why do you simply unravel me?" she murmured into my blouse front. "I can't think about anyone but you." "I keep doing things I've never done before. Some good, like helping a worthy man try to win a big city mayoral election. And some definitely bad, no matter which way you cut it. Like conducting an affair with a married woman." That night with Marie Chamberlain, I did another thing I'd never done before. Locking her eyes with mine, I ripped open my blouse with both hands, blasting buttons everywhere. I'd always wanted to do that, but was too cautious and cheap. What if I tore the placket? What if the buttons were sewn on so well I couldn't pop them off at first try, and I'd look like an idiot? Except Marie Chamberlain unraveled me just about as much as I unraveled her, so I did it. And she laughed in surprise and amusement. We flung ourselves onto the bed, and I remember my bra being twanged off, and I remember her smooth calves and silver strappy shoes. The shoes went flying, too. Marie wanted it fast and fierce, and against my usual habits, so did I, just with her. Because of her. Normally, I like to take things slow and easy, you know, candles and imported chocolates, fresh fruit for starters. Then perhaps some lovely lotion, exploration, experimentation, and slow surprises. But with Marie, as soon as we'd be alone, we'd fall upon each other like estrogen-crazed bonobos. Afterward, we'd talk, cuddle, and nibble those Belgian chocolates and tangerines. A drop more brandy, please. No hurry now. Marie lay in my arms, sighing. I stroked her hair, enjoying its richness. My fingers traveled down the firm column of her neck, where her pearls lay so cool and smooth. The room, on the 19th floor of the swanky Westin Book Cadillac, overlooked the city, which always appeared more glamorous at night. The luminous skyscrapers, the cars flowing along Washington Boulevard, the broad black swath of the river, and the lights of Windsor across the way. From a perch like this, Detroit never looked so good. Moreover, it's hard to beat a luxury hotel as a love nest. What did Oscar Wilde say? Let me be surrounded by luxury I can do without the necessities. Right on, brother. Part of the savor for Marie, I have to admit, was the danger. We never should have taken a room in a downtown hotel. Too risky. But tonight the Book was super convenient. We just worked our butts off at a Friday evening cocktail party fundraiser for our candidate for mayor, Leon Sorrell, in one of the ballrooms. The take was disappointing, just shy of $15,000, and half of that would go to the hotel for costs. Still, Sorrell seemed pleased. Which pleased me, because, you know, happy candidate, happy staff. Marie and I discussed the evening. I never guessed Sorrell would have a tin ear for promo, I said. He should be much more polished by now. She was right. This was the last weekend in September, and the November 2nd election would be upon us before we knew it. Marie Chamberlain was the type I never thought I'd make it with. Sharp, sophisticated, experienced, feminine in that classic way of hair salons, facials, and the kind of knowing sexuality you only see in old movies. She was about my age. We're all middle-aged at this point, right? But she didn't show much of it. Great figure, excellent taste in clothes, good lips, always colored a pleasing shade of muted fuchsia. That muted fuchsia sounds too much, doesn't it? But I stand by my description of muted fuchsia, which if you think about it and give it a chance would probably improve the appearance of any number of women, were they open-minded enough to try it. There was nothing believable about Marie Chamberlain's attraction to me, except for one thing which finally came up in our discussion. Why do you take me apart so? Marie said, nuzzling my neck. This bed was mighty comfortable. You seriously want to know?
Yes, damn you.
I'm the Great Awakener. It was true. Straight women tend to like me. Every few years, one decides she really likes me but doesn't understand why. I think it has to do with a certain androgyny I present. My brown hair is neither boy cut nor long, usually a chin-length bob. I have hips like a mouse, as my Aunt Rosalie puts it, but also C-cup boobs. While I can wear a skirt and lip gloss without coming across like a stevedore in drag, my standard uniform is jeans, unironed linen blouse, and old-style penny loafers or sneakers. I carry a simple shoulder purse, a bit of yin, a bit of yang. Top it off with my earnest face and ability to reflect people's best selves back to them. When a woman is ready to question certain aspects of her life, someone like me can come in handy. And they use me to answer a question for themselves, and then we all move on. I don't hold it against them. I see these situations as more or less a service project with fringe benefits. I knew Marie Chamberlain was falling in love with me before she knew she was falling in love with me. I can pinpoint the exact moment, in fact. She had come to see me in my office in the storefront Leon Sorrell had rented upon the launch of his mayoral campaign. Whatever it was she wanted to talk about, an interoffice phone call would have done, but she found it necessary to exit her office in the back, walk 20 paces to mine in the front, stick her head in, get invited to sit and discuss it. Then instead of leaving, she brought up the latest poll numbers. She sat in my one extra chair, a chrome and vinyl job from some doctor's waiting room, her legs crossed, looking like she wanted a cigarette, though she didn't smoke. "I don't know," she said. "I thought we'd be in better shape with the over-55s by now." "Yeah," I said. "But given that we're up against an incumbent with a lot of power, we're not doing too bad. We've had some good placement in the press."
"Thanks to you."
"Well, anyway, I should get back to it."
"What are you doing for lunch?"
"I thought I'd get a souvlaki. There was a place down the block."
"Is it good?"
"Yeah. They have any kind of gyro you want, plus, you know, burgers and stuff. Lemon meringue pie."
"Is that your favorite?"
"Lemon meringue? Yes. It's my favorite pie." She drummed up a few more minutes' worth of conversation, then went quiet for a minute, eyes lowered. She slammed her hands on the chair arms, looked at me full on, and as if quite surprised, declared, "I enjoy your company." The look on her fine-featured face was half pleasure, half bafflement. "I'm that queer person you can see yourself having a drink with in a halfway decent bar, playing cards with, dancing with, maybe even. In this case, going up to a room in a luxury hotel with, consuming Chateaubriand, strawberries, and a charming Bordeaux with. Married women are dangerous, everybody knows that, especially ones married to guys who have A, hefty financial means, B, friends with power, and C, no clue. Marie's husband, Lawrence Chamberlain, was an influential business broker who knew everybody. By the same token, women like Marie Chamberlain can be incredibly exciting. "Well," I said. We ate lunch together that day, and things escalated pretty fast. I learned that her husband, Lawrence, was mean to her. Their son, Yates, was an Eagle Scout, ran marathons for charity, and was just out of college, living at home and job hunting. His dream was to launch his own business someday. The Chamberlains owned a big house in Sherwood Forest, one of the top neighborhoods on the west side next to Palmer Woods. I learned about her tattoo, a spray of pink rosebuds just above her right breast, which she'd acquired in celebration of her 30th birthday. She said she'd wanted to do something youthful and for the hell of it. The tattoo was lovely, and I enjoyed tracing the little flowers with my finger. I might add the important fact that Marie had brains, a degree in history, another in political science, plus just a general thirst for ideas. She liked the theories of Carl Jung and the novels of Jane Austen. Both of us enjoyed trying to figure out what made people tick. We'd been seeing each other secretly for about 3 weeks now, and I was getting more and more enamored of her. At the same time, I was getting more and more uncomfortable with the arrangement. 2. Neither of us wanted to end the night. Though it was my habit to get out first, no later than early dawn, I felt safest that way. It was about 2:30. Marie sat up and poured glasses of water for us.
"You met Leon when you were reporting on the DiMedjo corruption story, right? He was the lead detective on that case, if I remember."
"Yeah, he was. Why?"
"He must have impressed you greatly."
"Indeed, he did," I told her about getting to know Leon Sorrell, then a Detroit police lieutenant, detective division, when I was doing an investigative piece for the Motor City Journal. My subject was a public medical organization that turned out to be even more crooked than anyone expected. Murders and other malfeasance occurred. Sorrell and I exchanged information in the case to mutual benefit. Although most police despise journalists like vegans despise McDonald's, I'd shown him I was trustworthy. I can keep my mouth shut. And although I'm still perfectly capable of making bad decisions for the sake of a story, I never blame anybody but myself when I get into a sideways shitstorm. "It was music to my ears," I said, when Sorrell told me he was beyond fed up with the crooked doings he saw in City Hall, as well as in the police department and, well, elsewhere. "Did you know he was considering running for mayor last time but didn't because he got sick? And when Andromeda Jacobs won yet another term,
he realized how screwed we were all going to be."
I loved her throaty voice. She sipped her water, making it seem like something especially fine. "Yeah," I said. "Thank God he got well. Sorrell had gotten prostate cancer, but they'd caught it early, and now his chances of dying from some other indignity were quite good. He asked me to be his press secretary," I said, and I came up with the less grandiose-sounding title of media manager. Leon was paying me $800 a week, which more than covered my skin-tight bills. Plus, I managed to eat plenty of meals at campaign headquarters.
"What will you do after the election?"
"Oh, back to freelancing."
"You have ink in your veins."
"Yeah, lots of red ink." She laughed. "And you?" I asked. "You know, I've missed some of the background between you and Leon. You both went to Cass, correct? Were you in the same grade?"
"Yes. He ran for class president, and I was his campaign manager."
Cass Technical High School, or Cass Tech, was the premier high school in the wonderful, struggling city we all called home. And what a city! Industry laid the modern foundation of Detroit, and industry, with its fickleness and depredations, almost destroyed it. Now the town was finding new ways to thrive and searching vigorously for more. "You were? I didn't know that," That is a tremendously cool fact.
I put up posters that said, "A vote for Sorrel is a vote for free hot chocolate."
Seriously?
He'd gotten a hold of like 10,000 expired packets of Swiss Miss, and he promised to make hot chocolate for everybody in the school if he won.
Where'd he get all the Swiss Miss?
Bought it from a back alley food distributor, some guy for $40. He had a paper route and saved his money.
And he won the election?
And we stood in the cafeteria at lunch, and the lunch ladies made hot water, and they all stood there filling cups until every kid had a cup of hot chocolate. There was enough to do it three times.
I laughed. That's a great story.
The campaign was not very substantive,
but effective.
Bread and circuses.
Yes! Ha! Who came up with that originally? Some Roman guy, right?
Yeah. She closed her eyes for a moment, thinking, then opened them. Juvenal, just after the time of Christ. Meaning most citizens are self-centered and stupid. And if you give them enough to eat plus a little entertainment, they'll be in your pocket. Or at least they won't rise up against you. Because then, who will give them those things?
I love that you know shit. I reached over and stroked her powder-smooth arm. So you and Sorrel were political allies from school days, and now you're his campaign manager for mayor of this city. I'll add that to one of his appreciative tweets about you.
Which you write.
The good ones, yeah, I write those. The others...
You should change his password so he can't keep fucking things up.
I did once, and he reamed me out, so... We have what we have. Sorrel had terrible instincts when it came to social media, which, as everybody knows, is more powerful than a crooked newspaper publisher in your pocket. He only ever tweeted about policy, but you have to give people a sense of you as well. One time I noticed he'd gotten new shoes. I said, "Leon, take a picture of your new shoes and say something funny about them." By faith, nobody cares about my shoes. They don't. Not literally, you're right, but they care about you, for God's sake. People are interested in details and tidbits. They want to feel like they know you. Being mayor is being the soul of the town, you know? You're not directing traffic. So say something about your shoes, or say something cool about the store you got them in. Where did you buy them, by the way? Cyril's on Gratiot. That's great! Cyril's was an old-style men's shop where the clerks wear a tape measure around their necks and affectionately insult the regulars. So he tweeted, "I got new shoes at Cyril's." That was the whole tweet. And it, indeed, was all caps. No photo. It got about 10 likes and no retweets, perhaps needless to say.
How did we even get to this point?
Marie said, lounging on one elbow, facing me in bed.
You and I.
I was sitting propped up against some pillows. When the student is ready, the teacher appears.
A wise person said that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And that's another reason I love you.
The reason what?
You're quick. You are so dear to me.
And you're simply divine. But I had to face reality. I had to gather myself to deliver an ultimatum. Back in a couple minutes, I went into the bathroom and got in the shower. As I soaped up under the hot water, one of my stress-induced internal arguments got going. Me. Just get out of the relationship now. Go now. Make a dignified exit. Me. But I love her, I think. I want to love her. I wish this could work. Me. Of course, but there are bigger things than fun, and you know you can't genuinely be... Me. Okay. I don't know for sure if I'm in genuine love. It's too early. Me. But in reality, it's too late. Me. Right. You know, that was almost poetic. I dried off, wrapped a fresh towel around myself, and returned to Marie's welcoming smile. You know this can't go on, I said,
perching on the edge of the bed. She let out an extended sigh.
I told you I'm leaving him. I never had it this good with Lawrence, you know.
That's great to hear. Seriously, but this is too dangerous for me.
You care that much?
Oh, God. I rubbed my temples to try to cool down my brain. We're talking past each other. I've broken my code of not sneaking around with somebody who's cheating on their mate. You know that. You said he's a shit. He's cheated on you for years, which, by the way, I have no way of knowing is true. He talks mean to you, all of that.
I will separate and get a divorce.
Have you seen a lawyer? Pause.
Yes.
You haven't. That's a lie, I can tell. I broke my rule because you convinced me you were days away from serving him with divorce papers or separation papers or whatever.
But still, here you are.
Well, of course. We're consenting adults. This is the most excitement I've had in... I didn't want to tell her literally. Ages. And I don't like your husband either, but I'm afraid the money's too good for you to actually leave him. I think that's the truth. And you've been lying to yourself more than me, even.
Lawrence doesn't give a damn what I do.
She continued to recline, but I was sitting up super straight now.
Then why do you feel the need to sneak around? You haven't told him about me, right?
No,
but that's too messy by definition. I'm not asking you to get married to me. I have no idea whether you and I could work things out long term, but I do know that while you're still married and we're still fooling around, my life could be on the line, or at least my livelihood.
Don't be melodramatic.
I'm not. I have no financial security and a tenuous reputation as a journalist in this town. Moreover, we only met, what, 5 months ago? And it's only been 3 weeks that we've...
I didn't think you were going to start an argument.
She sat up and crossed her legs beneath her.
Marie, I don't think you understand what it means to step out of your lifelong role as a straight woman married to a distinguished type, successful guy, and into, well, the parallel universe of queerdom.
She leaned forward, head bowed.
Why do I have to step out of anything?
I rest my case.
I love you, Lillian. Come on.
And you light my fire. Honestly, I think you're terrific, but damn it, I don't want to pressure you to leave Lawrence. You say you love me, but it's just too soon for you to know that for real.
She looked up. In the lamplight, her eyes were wistful.
Do you love me?
Oh, hell, I want to say yes, but it's too soon for me, too.
Marie toyed with her pearls, which had stayed on during the evening's activities, a lovely double strand that seemed to enjoy being around her neck.
For purporting to be such a free spirit, you're more hidebound than I thought.
I have standards. I picked up my water glass and drained it. Fuck. I have made a mess.
It's not like voters would care that Leon Sorrell's campaign manager and media person are having an affair. It wouldn't be a scandal about him.
Are you kidding? Sorrell's base is way more conservative than you think. Moreover, Andromeda would try to leverage this as much as possible. Sorrell hires queers and cheaters to run his campaign.
I left her thinking and went into the bathroom and changed into the fresh underwear and T-shirt I'd thrown into my shoulder bag. I came out and found my jeans, then wadded up my torn open blouse and stuffed that into my bag. I left the buttons on the floor. I sat down next to her.
And here's another thing. I think your problem's more personal than what's going on between us. Even if you and Lawrence split up, you're not going to like being seen as AC/DC.
I used the term I'd learned in my parents' bar when I was a kid long ago.
Ha! That would be considered the height of cool in the crowd Lawrence and I run with. I'd love to show you off to them.
You wouldn't be in that crowd anymore. But I knew what she meant. For some in the upper echelons, an open-air queer affair shows you're downright happening. I have to go, I said.
When will I see you again?
We need some time off, until you get your situation sorted out.
Don't go yet, she caressed the pillow.
And had I known that was the last time I would see Marie Chamberlain, I would have stayed. I'd have said okay to one or two more go-rounds. I'd have risked staying until checkout time. I'd have told her at least once more that she was the sexiest woman I'd ever made love to. 3. When I left the hotel room, it was 4 o'clock, the ideal time not to bump into anybody in the lobby or on the streets. The clubs close at 2. By 4 on a Saturday morning, the whole town feels deserted. Even the cops are off the streets for the most part. I drove up Woodward in the pleasant pre-dawn freshness to my apartment in Hamtramck, past the ruined apartment blocks, interspersed with encouraging pockets of renewal. The trees in the side neighborhoods were close to their peak of flaming autumn gorgeousity. Half of me felt I should resign myself to not seeing Marie anymore, and half of me burned with a desire to phone her and make another passionate date. She certainly outclassed me socially. The Chamberlains were solidly on Detroit's A-list. I had neither power nor great wealth, though I'd earned minor notoriety with the investigative pieces I'd written for the Motor City Journal. The Chamberlains came from old Detroit money, both of them, and they lived in a gorgeous house that Lawrence's grandfather had built before the Depression. Lawrence had inherited millions from a series of patents his great-grandfather had owned for chemical processes, for automotive paint technology. Those processes wound up being used in defense contracts for military vehicles as well, so you can imagine. Paint technology would seem such a simple thing, even a small thing. But there are people walking around Detroit with quiet millions from patents on something like a bonding agent for metal flake applications, let alone all the tiny relay switches, plastic films, custom bolts. The list is endless. Lawrence had leveraged his inheritance into a brokerage business that handled only tippy-top clients. Marie's family were a branch of the Brodeurs, who had received massive land grants in the aftermath of the War of 1812. They owned something like 30% of Detroit at the turn of the 20th century, and it was common knowledge that they still held most of that, in the form of skyscrapers downtown and half of the waterfront. I climbed the stairs to my apartment, sad and worried. But as soon as I got in the door, my rabbit Tommy came bumping up to me and my spirits lifted. There's something about the presence of a good animal, isn't there? They live in the here and now, their needs are simple, and they couldn't care less that the world of humans is rife with treachery, as well as love and beauty. I'm not so soppy about pets that I fancied Tommy loved me. His calm presence was enough. I certainly loved him. Like his late grandpa, Todd, who was my first rabbit, Tommy was a middle-sized Lapin with short brown fur. He took after Todd in being easy to train, at least in matters of not chewing on electrical cords or low-hanging furniture and not marking his territory. I'd gotten him fixed, as the euphemism goes. He had the run of the place, and he was sensible enough to keep that privilege. I might add that he groomed himself fastidiously, which I always appreciate in both pets and humans. This apartment was working out well. My former landlords, Mr. and Mrs. McVitty, had gotten too elderly and sick to keep up their house on the north side, where I'd lived upstairs for many years. Their sons had moved them to an assisted living place in Marquette, way in the Upper Peninsula, where most of their relations still lived. My new little apartment occupied the floor above a barber shop and a vest pocket market on Florian Street in Hamtramck. My landlord was a young Russian guy whose people had come from Ukraine a few generations back. He was the main barber in the shop, and his cousin ran the grocery. Hamtramck, a city within a city, lay in the heart of Detroit. You pronounced it Hamtramck, as if that missing I were indeed there. The place started out mostly Polish, lots of factory workers coming over for jobs in the plants. Then things changed, and now most folks had roots in Russia or the Middle East.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?